Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
The Human Zoo, where they don't hide away the sick animals.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the great dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Stand to attention when I'm talking to you!
On Talk Radio.
It's mess!
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here at Talk Radio. We are, of course, the seekers of truth and justice on this show. We are not going to be misled by politicians. We are not going to allow them to tell us lies. We are not ever going to put up with the sort of nonsense that some of these politicians get away with on other broadcasting outlets. We will always question politicians. We will always ask them, if are you sure that that's a statistic you want to use? I will make sure I get it from you where exactly where you got it from. However, what I do not wish to do is to drag anybody who says something which turns out not to be true through the court system of this country. What is happening right now in a private prosecution against Boris Johnson is, quite frankly, not only a travesty of justice, but a travesty of the political system within which we are all supposed to be working. Just because some bloke who decides he doesn't want to leave the European Union can now crowdfund himself to the tune of a couple of £100,000 and he can try and bring down the best chance we've got of leaving the European Union as a candidate to lead the Tory party, I think, is a complete and utter nonsense. I've no idea who this judge is in the Crown Court of La La Land, but she needs to get a proper and soon upbraid about what her position seems to be. When she wants to operate as a judge, she does not operate as judge, jury and executioner. The idea that Boris Johnson has somehow broken the unwritten law of politics by saying something which turned out not to be true, we might as well start locking up Anna Soubry. We might as well start suing Nick Clegg. We might as well bring David Cameron back and say, I thought you said this was one vote in a lifetime. I thought this was one generation that would have only one chance. What about George Osborne? He said there would be 500,000 people out of work by now if we voted to leave the European Union. Well, that was wrong as well. This is absolutely ill-designed, badly managed and completely misappropriated justice, and I think we need to stop it, and we need to stop it right now. 0344 499 1000. As Julie Hartley Brewer said, we don't want politicians lying to us, but it's our job to make sure that they don't get away with it. We don't need to start locking them up and prosecuting them just because we've got some secret agenda against them. 0344 499 1000. I know that you're going to support me on this one. This is Talk Radio. I'm Mike Graham. It's the Independent Republic.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, it's come to something, has it not, when you see headlines in newspapers in which basically the former mayor of London, who wasn't even in the government, by the way, when he was campaigning for the referendum to leave in 2016, is somehow now prosecuted by some guy who's got an axe to grind against the leaving situation from the European Union. The character who we're talking about, of course, is Marcus Ball. He seems to have got a bee in his bonnet. He's a sort of Gina Miller type figure who doesn't want us to leave the European Union. The problem we've got here is there's too many lawyers, too many experts, too many people who are trying to find ways of stopping us from doing what the public wants us to do. Let's talk to Bob Seeley, Conservative MP for the Isle of Wight, a man we speak to a lot on this show, a man who normally will talk perfect sense. Bob, a very good morning to you.
Morning, that's very nice of you to say that. I hope to try to continue in that noble tradition.
Well, indeed. I mean, listen, I hold myself to account. I hold politicians to account. I take great pride in the fact if some politician comes on here and tries to sort of flam me with some ridiculous statistic, yeah, which I think is questionable, I question it. But seriously, yeah, we cannot surely be going down this road of prosecuting individual politicians for saying things which turn out not to be true.
Yeah, no, it's really bad for our democracy. I mean, we could probably compile quite a good list of people who have knowingly lied about Brexit, about the claims that all these damaging things that haven't come to pass, and we could probably spend the next few days going around making citizens arrest.
Yeah.
You know, Nick Clegg, George Osborne, David Cameron, some ex-colleagues, some current colleagues. The list is endless.
Yes.
So this is very politically motivated, and the problem is with our democracy at the moment is when those people who've lost refuse to accept the result, it damages democracy, and you get instability, you get people who refuse to play by the rules. And I think that is really damaging.
And when I said I think it's about having too many lawyers around, I think that really is quite an important point, because there are always lawyers to be found who will be able to make a case for anything. But the idea that this Crown Court judge has fallen for it, to me, is staggering.
Well, yeah, I'm just wondering about this. I mean, I don't know if one has to be careful what one says when talking about the law and judges. But if judges become politicised, and I wonder if this person has, I'm not saying so, but I don't know. If judges become politicised and are used in political argument, then I think it's a really dangerous precedent, and it just weakens our democracy. One may or may not like a judge's politics, but judges need to keep politics out of their decision-making. And actually, I think she's wrong in substance, and I think she's wrong in the politics of this, but she's certainly wrong in the law. And it's a really dangerous and foolish step.
Well, apart from anything else, just on the law and on the judicial situation, she made a point and made a very clear point that it was for the government not to campaign during referendums. But in fact, Boris Johnson wasn't in the government. He was the Mayor of London. So, she's got that. She makes the exception and then ignores it.
I think she's hopelessly confused.
Yeah.
If this is the quality of judges in this country, God help us.
Yeah, absolutely right. Because like you say, we don't want to go down the American route, where I've seen people going to local polling stations on election day, voting for judges, voting for sheriffs, voting for police chiefs.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument. Okay, there's arguments for and against that. But what you certainly, I wouldn't, on the whole, I wouldn't want that. Especially not with judges, because you expect them to be properly vetted and not vulnerable to popular whim, for or against one's own position, whatever one's politics. You expect them to be independent and to uphold a non-politicised version of the law. And when they don't, it is genuinely troubling. And I think this is a ridiculous decision.
Yeah.
I think it can be far more easily... I mean, if one was prosecuting politicians for lying, let's get the Treasury in the dock for all the claims they made after the 2016 referendum, because that is provably false.
And all the economic forecasts that get made by various chancellors through the years.
Absolutely. And if I was a governor of the Bank of England, I'd probably be getting my defence lawyers ready by now for facing life imprisonment.
Quite.
If you want to go down that route. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, as a general kind of philosophical point, have we reached this kind of nadir now in British politics where there is no such thing as truth? Because, your truth isn't the same as my truth. His truth is different from her truth. It's ridiculous.
I think there's a lot of silly noise and damaging noise and a lot of insults being flying around. And if you look at some people who are hard over Remainers, I think their contempt for the vote and their contempt for the people who voted is genuinely an extremely unattractive thing to see, and their contempt for democracy. It comes back to the original point. Democracy works when everyone accepts the results, and if some people don't accept the results and think that people are too stupid or too old to have a valid opinion, then you sort of get in the realms of a very sort of fascistic mindset where some votes count more than others and you're going to count your votes more than other people's. And then you're in real sort of, Eastern European territory in the bad old days.
Yeah, exactly right. And a lot of people do fear that that is where we are headed, because I was having a conversation with somebody last night about this. The bottom line for me is that if you want to encourage a sort of Donald Trump-esque candidate to emerge out of the wilderness, this is exactly how you do it. Because people lose faith in the system, they lose faith in democracy, they lose faith in the way that people are represented in Parliament. And the fact that somebody like John Bercow yesterday announces in America that he's actually thinking he might just hang around for the precise purpose of blocking Brexit, people are going, what is going on?
Yeah, it's really bad. I'm not quite sure where to start with that. For my political party's part, this is like a marriage that's gone wrong, and one side has done something really dumb. Mm. We basically said to our spouse, whether it's a he or a she, love, you're going to decide this issue, and we're going to respect you. Our spouse has come back with a decision that maybe we weren't entirely expecting. I mean, I voted for Brexit. I'm happy with it. But our spouse has come back with a decision that some of us don't like. And effectively what we've done is we've patted him or her on the knee and said, love, you're too stupid to make the decision. I'm changing my mind.
Yeah.
So not only is our spouse irritated by the fact that we are ignoring her decision or his, but what they are also irritated about is the lack of trust. So what we need to do is twofold. We need to deliver on the results of the referendum, and then we need to be exceptionally, in political terms, we need to do an awful lot of flower buying and, washing up and doing odd jobs around the house for the next year or two to get ourselves back in our spouse's good books. And that's basically what's happened between our party and the electorate, and to be honest, probably all parties in the electorate.
Yeah.
So we need to pull our finger out.
And I think the Tory party also has to stop doing what it does very well, which is kind of eating itself from within, whereby we get this ridiculous kind of public face of the Tory party with people saying, oh, yes, we're going to campaign cleanly, which is always a very bad kind of announcement to make, because immediately that you say we're all going to campaign cleanly, everybody knows that that's exactly what's not going to happen, and there's going to be all sorts of briefing and counter-briefing going on.
I really hope on that, that when people do make criticisms, they're just, you know, in the open, and that we above all have a clean debate. I'm certainly not going to take part in a dirty one because I want to have a decent reputation, and my colleagues who want to continue to have a decent reputation should be doing likewise,
yes.
Frankly.
And what about those who say, actually, this is more damaging to Boris's leadership ambitions than it is anything else, really? It's not going to... I mean, nobody's that surprised that Boris Johnson is being targeted because he is the kind of the front runner, if you like, even though Michael Gove seemed to rise above him slightly in the polls the other day. You know, he is the front runner. He is what the Remain sort of group see as the nightmare scenario.
Well, I mean, I'm supporting Gove because I think we need someone who'll expose Corbyn in Parliament. I think we need someone who will renew us in office, and I think we need somebody who respects and is going to try to respect and preserve the union and deliver Brexit. But having said that, I'm very protective of Boris, because Boris is a good bloke, and I found him, to be honest, to be thoroughly reliable, despite people telling me that he wasn't,
right.
and a thoroughly decent guy. And when there is a welter of criticism that he's going to face, probably, but actually a lot of it is unfair. For people like me, I feel rather protective towards my colleague, because I think the way that he is being targeted by vindictive, anti-democratic, extremist, obsessive Remainers is incredibly bad for our democracy. So absolutely, I will defend Boris on this. In the short term, it may actually make him more popular, because people will see him as someone who is being bullied by the Gina Millers or whatever, this 29-year-old who seems to be spending quite freely other people's money or having a good time when he's trying to take Boris to court.
Mm.
You know, all these other people. And I think people are going to be defensive of Boris and say, good on you for standing up for us, the people, because there's 17 million of us who voted Brexit.
Well, this could all backfire horribly on the guy who's bringing the action, couldn't it? Because at the end of the day, Marcus Ball is now going to have his life turned upside down by the newspapers. The Daily Mail today's got a piece about how he managed to take £24,000 out of the fighting fund to pay himself. You know, he's not going to be painted in the finest light, because whatever he may say, he's not doing this to save democracy or to stop politicians lying. He's got a secret agenda.
I'm wary of his... I don't know what his motives are. Apparently, he was deleting tweets that said basically he's trying to stop Brexit,
right,
which completely undermines this judge's unwise judgment.
Mm.
But, you know, if he starts... I mean, I don't know the basis on which he's got all this money, but if he's got all this money for a court case and he's spending it on putting himself up in London or self-defence classes or God knows what else, maybe people who are giving him money are going to be saying, oh, maybe I won't be giving you money in future, and actually you're meant to be using that for a court case and not for yourself. But
yes,
who knows?
I don't want to comment on him,
because I think he's pretty insignificant, no disrespect to him. And I think there are many, many much more significant arguments to be had about what is happening and the way that people like Adonis or this guy or Gina Miller, the way they hold their fellow countrymen in respect or lack of it, which I think is very damaging for us. And as I say, democracy rests on everyone accepting the results. And when some people don't, then that is a bad thing for the stability of our political...
Also, no matter how bad our system may have become, it is still a system which works. It is still a democratic system. None of these people, like Lord Adonis, like Gina Miller, like this guy, as you say, are... you can't do anything with them. They're not elected representatives of the people. Adonis tried to become one, and guess what? They didn't fancy that very much, and so he's never been elected anywhere in his life.
It's really bizarre, because he was saying that the BBC... he put out a tweet this morning. He said the BBC should be up in the dock or something.
Oh, yeah.
So not only does he want Boris tried, but he wants the BBC put on trial as well. And considering there is recently accepted to be a sort of soft left, slight bias on the way the BBC does things, you know, we can all live with it, it's not the end of the world. For a Remain campaigner who was a member who was standing for the Labour Party at the time, now to say that the BBC should be put on trial, I mean, this is just incredible.
It really is. Absolutely unbelievable. And also, who is he speaking for? You know, with whose authority does he issue these dictums? And why should we do what he wants?
I think he's speaking to other people, basically sort of urban elites and people who are really obsessed by Remain, for whom membership of the European Union is a sort of ideological step rather than just practical trading and political arrangement. and who are resting a great deal of psychological and emotional energy on being part of it. And the British people voted against it. I'm afraid to say some people just can't accept the results.
And is there any part of you which now sees a second referendum looming up large before we see maybe another general election? Because in the end, it might be that the Leave voters, or the Leave, the Leave side, if you like, for want of a better word, should just say, all right, then let's have a second referendum because Leave's going to win it anyway.
Well, OK, I'm trying to. The only logical... The best thing that I can do, in my own opinion, is to stick to what we said in our manifesto. And I haven't got it in front of me, but it was basically, we will leave and we'll try to get a deal. Mm. So I want to leave with a meaningful Brexit deal. That means probably not a customs union, unless at the next election we absolutely have the chance to turn that into something much more than a customs union. But even that, I'm pretty uncomfortable with. I want us to leave on the 31st of October because we told the British people we would leave. I didn't vote for the extension, and I'm not happy that we've got an extension up till the 31st. I felt we should have left with or without a deal because we need to risk. The most important thing now is not so much Brexit, but it's actually our relationship with the people of this country. And it's about delivering on the promises that we made. And the British people gave us an instruction. At the general election, they gave us another instruction because 80% of votes went to the two major parties. Both have said, we respect the result. And last week, they gave us another. At this point, they're shouting. They're not telling us what they want us to do. They're shouting at us what we need to be doing. And some of us, I'm afraid to say, including senior members of the government, are still tone deaf to what they are being told by the British people.
They're still not getting it, is a lot of the messages I'm getting on Twitter. Bob, as ever, thank you very much indeed. Bob Seeley, Conservative MP for the Isle of Wight, supporting Michael Gove for the leadership of the Conservative Party, but does not agree that Boris Johnson should be targeted in this way by this character who seems to think that it is God-given right to protect democracy single-handed. I mean, who is this Marcus Ball character? I want to know. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, the suggestion at the moment is that we are sort of hamstringing ourselves and hamstringing the future entrepreneurs and business people of the next few decades by loading them up with loads and loads of debt so that when they leave university with a degree which may or may not be worthwhile, having spent 3 or possibly 4 years doing it, they owe loads of money and they'll never really be able to pay it back. Let's talk to Nick Hillman, who's director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Nick, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I think there's probably no doubt, I think everybody would agree, that we've now got a situation where too many people have got too much debt and they're never really going to be able to pay it off.
Well, you say that and it seems logical, but young people have been voting with their feet and going to universities in very big numbers. And the report, I mean, for me, it feels like Christmas Day today, a 250-page report on the finer details of higher education, you know, it is fantastic. And it really goes into a lot of detail. And one of the things it says is actually it thinks too many people might have been going to university and not enough to further education colleges, you know, which is a contentious argument, but they've got some strong evidence.
Yes, I think that's true, though, because as I say, I mean, when I seem to recall, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here on the statistics, but when I went to university back in, I don't even want to say the late 70s, but it was the very late 70s, I think it was only about 5% of the then sort of teenage population was going. And then it rose up to about 30%. And I think now it's over 50%, isn't it?
It's almost bang on 50%. So it's been growing almost every year since you went.
Right.
And it's almost about 50%. So, you know, employers recruit graduates, they pay graduates more, but the feeling which is in the report is that we're not so good as a country at technical, vocational education. So we're sending lots of people through universities to get arts degrees like I did, and maybe not enough of the skills that employers say are currently in shortage.
Right. I mean, funnily enough, we're going to be talking later on in the show about how we need more vets in this country, apparently. I hear all the time that we need more nurses, we need more doctors, you know, we need more people who are skilled in one particular field, but at the moment it's a field that we keep sort of encouraging people to come in from abroad to do.
Yes, and it's interesting, all three of those occupations have very high training costs.
Yeah.
So obviously, training a doctor or a vet takes a long time and costs a lot of money. So there are some artificial restrictions. You know, the government says they'll only fund a certain number of doctor places each year. And, you know, if I'm not making pro or anti-Brexit point, But if Brexit means it's harder for employers to recruit people from abroad, we are going to have to recruit more people here.
Mm, exactly right. And is it possible, for example, to dissect the higher education sector more? Because presumably at the moment, there's a pretty standard fee. Because one of my sort of problems with the Blair encouragement of universities to become businesses, if you like, which is what many of them are, was to say, oh, you can charge up to £9,000 a year, which, of course, they all immediately did. I mean, nobody was going to go, oh, well, we could charge £9,000, but we're only going to charge you £5,000.
So Blair introduced £3,000 fees maximum, and they all charged that. Then the coalition introduced £9,000, and they all went immediately to the maximum. And the report is worried about that. So what they say is, look, £9,000 is actually not enough to train a doctor or an engineer, but it's more than enough to teach a classroom subject like history or English language.
So I guess what I'm saying is, should the universities themselves, the institutions, not be better at sort of pricing different degree courses differently?
Well, what they would say to you is, look, the more money we have, you know, we're not a profit-making company, the more money we have, then the better the education will be, because we will reinvest the money in people's education. But what the report's worried about, and this is fair, is that people are taking on debts that are so big, most people aren't paying them back in their entirety. And so what the report says is, have lower debts for all, but have slightly bigger government contributions to universities to cover those extra teaching costs, and extend the repayment period, which may be unpopular, but extend the repayment period so that more graduates pay off the whole of their loans.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say to me, and many people have tweeted me today about this, that the big problem for a lot of people is the interest. And if the interest was either less reduced or done away with altogether, that would be fairer.
Yes, the interest can be high, so it can be 3% above inflation.
Right.
So some years that can be 6-7% interest. And what the report today recommends, which I think is sensible, is get rid of real interest, at least for people while they're studying. Because what happens is, you leave your degree, open your first statement from the student loan company, and you're shocked by how much interest has been added.
Yeah.
So they say, don't get rid of interest for everybody, but at least get rid of it while you're studying.
Yeah. And also, the kind of the fear factor is something that people worry about. I mean, I was talking to some of the people in the office here, you know, who've gone through the system. And basically, if you've got a debt that's hanging over you, albeit that you might be thinking, I don't have to pay it back, absolutely, it's not that important, you know, I'll make enough money one day and finally I'll do it, you know, but there's nothing worse than having a kind of, it's almost like an albatross around your neck and you can't forget that it's there.
Yes, I think that's fair. And the loans will come down if the report is implemented because, for example, maintenance grants will come back in. But I've got to say, that fear that the people in your office express is much more common among parents than it is among students themselves. Students put off the worry for another day, whereas the parents do worry about this for their young children.
Right. Now, also, how about this? And you probably know this, being a sort of an education specialist. But in Spain, apparently, the system is that you get rewarded for doing well academically. So, for example, if you do get a distinction one year, get a sort of you're aiming for a first, your fees will actually be reduced the following year. That seems to me to be a great idea.
Yeah, I have heard that idea before, and you had it before. It is interesting. I don't think it's perfect because, for example, what if your parents die while you're at university? It screws up your academic achievements, even though you may be working quite hard. Or you're having to work very long hours in a shop because you haven't got enough money to pay your rent. So you have to be a bit careful with mechanisms like that. But I think it's certainly right that if people do well educationally, it's right that that's rewarded in some way or other. Our system tries to reflect it by saying, well, if you get a better paid job afterwards because you've done better, you'll pay off your loan more quickly. But of course, if you go become a nurse, you might be a brilliant student. You're never going to be that well paid because as a country, we've chosen not to pay nurses maybe enough.
Right. And as far as the actual repayment system goes, presumably there's going to be a lot of people. We're hearing from this report that many people will still be paying it off in their 60s. There'll be people who unfortunately never pay it off, or maybe who die a bit younger. There'll be people who just don't ever pay it off.
Yes. And in a way, that's a positive feature of the system, because it means if you never get a well-paid job, or you have a long-term health condition or something that means you can't earn lots of money, then the government will eventually pay off that debt for you. But the recommendation today is that should not happen until 40 years after you've graduated, rather than 30 years currently. So it will be hanging over you until you're close to retirement age.
Right.
And there are good arguments as to why they're recommending that. It makes the system more affordable. But other people are pointing out on social media, are the Conservatives really going to go into the next election in their manifesto saying one of our great popular policies is going to be make you repay your student loan for 10 years longer? It's an interesting question politically how that lands.
Well, it is. And it's also an interesting question politically overall as to whether the government gets involved in and sort of discouraging people from going to higher education establishments when it might be better for them not to bother and to try and get themselves into the sort of employment market.
Yes, that's true, although we are living longer. And I think, despite everything in today's report, the appeal of a three-year degree living away from home with other people your same age may continue to be quite strong. For many of us, our university days are some of the best days of our lives, and that will
continue, depressing.
I think.
That's depressing, well, isn't it? I mean, if those are the best days of your life, then you need to sharpen up your life.
Well, I don't know. I think it depends what you're doing. So if the degree you're obtaining while you're at university turns out to really improve your life chances afterwards, and you have a good time while you're getting it, then that's great. But one of the concerns in the report, and this, you know, let's be honest, universities pay my salary, but one of the criticisms in the report of universities that is valid is that some of the courses they're putting on are not delivering much better life outcomes for their students. So the students are taking on large debts and not necessarily getting very different types of jobs or more highly skilled work afterwards.
So that's not really working for anybody because the government's not getting the money back. The individual's not getting a better education to the point where their life is improving and they're making more money. So there's not much point in doing it, is there? But they've made the choice to do that.
So for most people, most of the time, university works out. At the extremes, and you're talking about one extreme, and it doesn't work out, you know, that is sad. And one of the things the report today says is it shines a spotlight on universities and says, look, you really need to get your own house in order on some of these courses, which are costing taxpayers and graduates money unnecessarily. And unless, it goes on and it says, unless you get your own house in order, the government should start cracking down on you. So that is a really important area to watch, I think,
yes,
over the next 2 or 3
because,
years.
I mean, the two things, I suppose, that worry me the most here are the higher educational institutions have become businesses. The people that run them are paid vast amounts of money now. And I know that you might say, well, not everybody is, but there's lots and lots of chancellors of universities pocketing, you know, not far off £500,000 a year, which to a lot of people is way over and above the sort of the pay grade that they should be on. I know what all the arguments are, but for me, it's just one of my bugbears. And the other thing that I would say about universities and higher education is that it's very class-driven. And it's very difficult if you're a young, white, working-class boy from Derby, for example, to go to university if none of your parents or none of your friends or none of your siblings have ever gone.
I accept most of that. I think the public relations disaster of vice-chancellor's pay has been a disaster for the sector. And you're right, white working class boys have the lowest entry rates of all into higher education.
Right.
And there are things on access to higher education in the report. My view is we shouldn't forget, though, how important economic agents, to use a horrible word, universities are to their towns and cities. You know, universities are often the biggest employer in a town or city. They bring thousands of students to spend money in the local shops and the businesses. They're often helping companies develop innovations and take them to market to be successful in the future. So the way that universities operate is not just teaching students. They're also integral to our whole economic success.
That may well be, but I don't think you can have both, really. I mean, you can, but you can't sell both, if you know what I mean. You can't say, on the one hand, universities are a great social experiment for people to go and enjoy, while denying access to them to a vast swathe of people in the country because they haven't got the right class. And secondly, well, you're then saying it's a business opportunity for so many people. Well, it can't be both.
Well, one of the things the report today recommends is that universities work much more closely with further education colleges and pull disadvantaged people through the further education college and then on to higher education to improve their life chances. And it talks about thinking about further education and higher education operating more cooperatively, more together.
Sure.
That is sensible. They do that in other countries. That is sensible. And of course, one of the ways of judging whether today's report is a success, if it's ever implemented, is whether that happens. And of course, one of the oddities about today is the Prime Minister has launched this big new report, but it'll be her successor that decides whether any of the changes in that report get implemented or not.
And well, so that is the trouble, isn't it? Pattern. That is the trouble, because, I mean, let's face it, let's stick with Derby, since I introduced it as the only town that, in Britain that I should pick on. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice if the University of Derby actually was a university for people from Derby, from perhaps, you know, less well-off backgrounds, rather than importing a load of middle-class kids from Surrey that they could sell beer to?
Well, I mean, as someone who grew up in Oxfordshire but went to school in Derbyshire, you know, I have a soft spot for Derbyshire, and I would like Derby University to be somewhere that is properly integrated with their local community and their local employers, and they are. You know, there's some great big manufacturing companies in Derby. But also, you know, why shouldn't, if someone wants to work in the, let's say, the aerospace industry, you know, Rolls-Royce, engines in Derby, has a good relationship with Derby University. Why shouldn't someone from Surrey go to Derby to learn about...
I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying that it shouldn't purely and simply be, let's import a load of middle-class people to our university and then create a load of employment in Derby for some working-class kids who are never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and I accept that. And it is absolutely true that although there are far more people from poorer families at university than ever before, there are still far, far, far more middle-class people. And I don't want fewer middle-class people to go to university. I want, you know, I hope my own children go to university. What I want is more open opportunities for everybody.
And less wasted opportunities, I think, as well.
I missed that.
I'd say fewer and less wasted opportunities as well.
Yes.
You know, fewer people going somewhere for 3 years, ending up costing the taxpayer loads of money, making somebody rich in a university, but not really making themselves any richer.
Yes, and one good thing the government has done is make the data much more available. So it's now possible for people to find out which courses lead to really good outcomes in the labour market and good salaries and secure work, and which ones don't. And that is useful information.
Yeah, and just one final question, Nick. Where would you be on shortening the course? For example, many people say to me, why not make the course a little bit more concentrated and do it in 2 years instead of three? I've got a tweet here from somebody called Felix who says, my daughter is in year two of a BA. She had no lectures after Easter. At last of only two exams yesterday, the cost is astronomical and the taught hours far lower than when I went in the 80s.
Yes, I mean, those options exist, by the way. There are universities that offer two-year degrees already, Staffordshire, Buckingham, where I'm actually a governor. So they do exist, and not every young person wants that because they want to be at university for as long as possible. And our degrees, even our three-year degrees, are shorter than in many other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, in Germany, typically you stay at university much longer. But if people want more accelerated degrees, they do exist and they should root them out, and they have very good outcomes for the people that do them.
Okay. Nick, thank you very much indeed. Nick Hillman there, Director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, on this government report, which has come out, basically telling us what we probably already knew, that the tuition fees are too high. Too many people are getting taught lessons and taking degrees which are not actually helping them out. Some student loans are not going to be paid back until people are in their 60s. Some I'm never going to be paid back. I want to hear from you on that one. 0344 499 1000. You'll have kids at university or kids who didn't go to university or kids who've been trained to do a job. I want to hear all your stories. You can tweet us as well at Talk Radio. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Lots more going on as well. Of course, coming up, we're going to find out what's wrong with Julian Assange, who apparently was too ill to appear in court today. He was due to appear and have a hearing about the extradition to the United States of America, where, of course, he doesn't want to go. We'll be talking to the Henry Jackson Society about that. But let's open up the debate this morning here, or this afternoon, I should say, with Chai Patel, who's Legal Policy Director at the JCWI, the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. Chai, very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we've heard an awful lot about how the government's going to change the rules on certain types of immigration, on certain types of freedom of movement, that people will have to come here only if they can promise that they're going to be making more than $30,000 a year and all of that kind of stuff. This is a slightly different report, is it not, in which we're being told that specific jobs are needing to be filled, specifically vets for some reason and some others.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make very much sense. And it's this problem that the particularly, I think a lot of governments have had this, but particularly this government, where they've made completely unrealistic promises on immigration.
Yeah.
They've claimed that they can bring immigration down to sort of, you know, levels that basically predate the current way that our economy is set up, the current way that our markets work. And it's always known that that's going to cause huge problems for certain industry sectors. And so what it's sort of saying now is we're just going to keep bowing to pressure from individual groups that make a good case that actually it's not going to work for them. And what you have then is you have a centrally planned economy where someone, you know, in the Home Office or in the cabinet basically micromanages how many chefs you allow in or
right.
how many... And that's just not the way that particularly a conservative government should be looking to manage the economy. It sort of makes absolutely no sense for them to talk about benefits of markets and of supply and demand, and then to say that, but we'll still be able to predict, you know, how many vets we're going to need next year.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chai, because it's kind of it's sort of part-time economic models that they're using, isn't it? Because they're not using them on every absolute thing that they could be using them on. And wasn't there a problem with chefs relatively recently, where an awful lot of Indian restaurants were saying, look, we can't get enough chefs in from Bangladesh and we can't get enough chefs in from the subcontinent because of some immigration rule that was causing them a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got the same things happening across different industries. I mean, obviously, you know, the most urgent problems around particularly this idea of the £30,000 threshold is with essential public services like the NHS,
right.
where, you know, and partly this is to do with just the NHS has always relied very much on experts and nurses and qualified experts from overseas. But also, you know, as you sort of referred to earlier, it's combined with a failure to sort of invest over the long term in training in this country, which means that when free movement ends, and we're already starting to see people not coming because they're worried about from Europe, because they're worried about what's going to happen in future. But when it ends, you're going to have this sudden huge shortfall in skilled staff working in the NHS, working in care homes. Because the government's decided that skilled means people that earn over £30,000 a year. And I think your listeners will know that, you know, almost everyone who works, in fact, everyone who works has a particular set of skills. And particularly when you're talking about people who are caring for the elderly, who are caring in hospitals, nurses, you know, have to carry out all kinds of sort of expert procedures because doctors are doing other jobs. You've sort of got a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Which, really important services.
Yeah, I mean, which genius came up with this £30,000 threshold? Because apart from the fact that it's higher than the average annual wage, it just seems entirely arbitrary, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the one important thing is not to let the government get away with the idea that this was an independent migration advisory committee that came up with the threshold. Because the migration advisory committee is a set of independent experts who the government asks questions of. And the way the government frames those questions very much determines the kinds of answers you get back. So the government has basically asked questions around where certain skills thresholds are set and what kinds of jobs are needed. They get, you know, you ask a very simplistic question, you're obviously going to get an answer that's not going to work for everyone.
Right.
And the government should really have taken what Mac said as a guide for roughly how you sort of think about future migration. Instead, they very much have tried to take this as a sort of arbitrary salary threshold, which says you're skilled if you're above £30,000, you're unskilled if you're below that. Yeah. And that's obviously ridiculous.
It is. Yeah, totally mad. And what about this thing called the shortage occupation list? I mean, I must be honest, I had no idea that such a thing existed. I'm sure you probably did. But, I mean, is there any point in having that? Because it's almost like, well, here's a whole load of exceptions that we're just going to continue to add to until actually the exceptions are bigger than the rule.
Well, I mean, you absolutely have to have it, given the current way immigration rules are set up, which is to basically say that outside of the shortage occupation list, it's incredibly hard to get a work visa, even if you're a skilled worker. Mm. And there's all kinds of salary thresholds and caps that are already in place. Up till now, it's been able to be a bit more limited because a lot of the sort of gaps have been filled by free movement with the EU, which is a very flexible immigration system that's allowed people to move wherever there's a demand for workers.
Yeah.
With that ending, or that, you know...
But that may not be ending, though. That's the other thing. I mean, there's nothing to suggest to me at the moment that that's ending.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think that that's something that needs to be taken into account. Even with free movement in place, there's always been a need for workers that come from overseas because, you know, from other countries outside Europe. And the shortage occupation list has been a way of preventing certain industries from, you know, really going to the wall because of the restrictive immigration controls. But it's, as we were saying at the beginning, it's just a terrible way of doing things because it's bureaucratic. It adds red tape. It means that you've basically got ministers and, you know, civil servants who have often no understanding of the industries in question deciding how many workers they're allowed to have.
Right. And also no real understanding of the jobs that they're wishing to fill. I mean, I'm seeing examples of professions on the list which include geophysicists, mining engineers, 3D computer animators, games. I mean, these are pretty specialised jobs. Cyber security experts. I mean, what if they get a load of applications from Russia? Are they just going to rubber stamp them and go, yeah, that's fine?
Exactly. I mean, I think this is one of those things where it doesn't make sense to have, a bureaucratic office in Whitehall deciding which particular kinds of programmer are allowed in to the country.
Right.
That's something that needs to adapt to, you know, what's happening in the real world. And there's absolutely no way that they're going to be able to keep up with that flow of information or have the expertise they need to know what's going to be best for the economy, what's going to be best for businesses that are trying to grow, and meet the needs of a global market.
And so long term, I suppose, which I know very few governments ever really even look at, rather than barely mention the phrase long term. But, I mean, we should presumably, because we keep hearing that there's going to be a shortage of GPs in the future, a shortage of nurses, even worse. So, where is the kind of the long term thinking from this government or any government saying, well, surely if we're so reliant upon other nations to supply our workforce, maybe we should get better at training our own people up?
Yeah, I mean, it's a two-part process. And I think the problem with the government is that they've always been putting the cart before the horse, which is to say, we need to restrict immigration. And then somehow magically that will mean that British people will get better jobs. And in fact, if you restrict immigration, it just means that businesses contract, they move overseas, they can't grow in the way that they want to. What you need to do is have a flexible immigration system that treats people humanely, that works for people, and combine that with a genuine investment in the long term, in education, in skills training, in apprenticeships, in all of the things that have been defunded in recent years, that mean that people in this country who grow up in this country, who are educated in this country, are free to go for jobs here or to go compete for jobs abroad if they want to move as well. And that's the sensible way of doing it. And instead, what we've seen is just the government thinking, and particularly under Theresa May, thinking that if you're just nasty to immigrants, somehow that solves the problems that we've been creating at home.
Well, I mean, politicians love a good, crackdown on immigration, even if it means absolutely nothing, because they think it sounds good and they think it might get them a few more votes in the next election. But the bottom line is, for example, I was talking to George Elphick the other day, the MP for Dover, about these people coming from Iran and Iraq in dirigible boats, right? And in the end, apparently, the people who have come here are still here because they can't be sent back. And they're coming to this country illegally.
Well, I mean, it's not illegal to claim asylum. So I would sort of dispute that slightly. I mean, anyone is entitled to seek asylum. And obviously, at the end of that process, it's up to the Home Office and the government to decide if they're genuine, if their claim is, is genuine or not.
No, but my point is, Chai, that they're coming here from countries from which they cannot be sent back to. So therefore, once they come here, there is no judgment to be made about them, their right to remain, because they can't be sent back, so they remain. Simple as that.
Well, I mean, if they can't be sent back, I mean, the reason they can't be sent back to Iraq is because it's a very dangerous country and people, are fleeing persecution from there. So that does suggest that their claims are genuine.
No, I get all that. I mean, it's a different argument. All I'm saying is that, they're making it much more difficult for people who are coming here to work than they are for people who are coming here for other reasons and who may be coming here illegally, which tells you the system isn't working very well.
I think what we see is they're cracking down across the board. And I think what we also see with our work and the clients that we have is it doesn't matter if they've come here as a... fleeing somewhere like Iraq, or they've come here from America or from France. In the end, what all people want to do is, whenever they've come to this country, they want to build lives here, they want to get a job, they want to work, and they want to contribute. And so I think what the government needs to recognize is very much the contribution that migrants make. And if there are problems at home, then I think, what we've seen is a massive dereliction of duty and successive governments on investing in people here. And remember that, for example, EU migration brings huge net benefits to the economy. What we've seen is those benefits to the economy have not been reinvested in the communities where people live, but have been siphoned off into tax cuts, into paying for the cost of austerity, where
I haven't seen
and the government
cuts.
Then blames the migrants.
I wish there were some tax cuts. I'm just wondering where they are. I haven't seen any.
So, the highest income, the rate of highest income tax was cut under.
Well, you mean after the Tories put it up, they put it back down again?
Yes, at a time when
it came back to where it was.
Than ever. Well, but that's how tax
but they also,
works. It goes up
well,
and down.
Yeah, I know so, it does. But they also but the raised but they also the raised the threshold so that you don't pay tax until you earn a lot more money. So it
which
swings benefit, around about.
Which has been a benefit to people in work. But remember, the poorest people in this country are the ones who were already below that threshold in the
sure,
first place.
But it's a good thing, isn't it? It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Terms, yeah, but it's a good thing that you could now earn £12,000 without paying any tax for everybody, isn't it?
It might well be, and I'm not saying that that's not a good thing. What I'm saying is that when you have migrants contributing to the economy, then their contribution needs to be recognised. And if there are problems with investment in communities, like, and you were talking about education and you were talking about our failure to have a good school system, then
it's
not good enough for the government to blame migrants.
Well, I don't think they are.
For the failures of
I don't
investment.
Think they are. What I'm saying, I'm not trying to have an argument about migrants or migration. Mm. What I'm saying is if we are in such a poor state in this country that we need vets to be imported from overseas, then we're not training enough vets. It's quite simple.
I agree.
Simple.
Well,
you know, it's
absolutely
not about whether we should
that.
Stop immigration or not. It's just about a much more broad and sensible policy that no government up to now in my lifetime has ever done.
No, I agree with that. I mean, the only thing I would say to that is that, of course, you should be training more people in areas where you need to and where people want, to work in those professions. But it's also not true to say that, I mean, we have always relied on immigration for very essential parts of our economy. The NHS would never have existed if it wasn't for, Caribbean and people from the Indian subcontinent coming, throughout the entire history of the NHS to work there, because there have never been enough doctors and nurses who have been trained to fill spaces.
Yeah, but don't you think that if you keep doing the same thing over and over again and failing,
that they should change it. But listen, Chai, we've got to run because we've overspent our time. Thank you very much indeed, Chai Patel, a legal policy director at the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. You know, some of the things he says are true. Some of the things he says are not quite the right, I have to say. Surely if we don't have enough doctors in this country, we train more of them. Simple as that. You don't keep going, oh, we have to keep importing them from other countries because we haven't got enough. We've got plenty of people here. We've got plenty of people going to university here, but there's not enough of them becoming doctors. So why can't we fix that? 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk Radio. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Gray. Matthew Wright here with you at 1 o'clock. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Hello has tweeted. He says, if going to university doesn't earn you more than $25,000 a year very quickly, then don't bother going. Get a manual job and a manual trade and you'll earn that in 6 months. Well, that is some of the best advice I think I've ever seen. There is absolutely no point in trying to go and do a job with a degree that isn't going to get you any decent money. You've wasted 3 years of your life, you've got a massive debt, and now you've got a pretty useless job as well. Felix says, my wife teaches A-levels. There are plenty of kids wanting to do veterinary science or medicine who have the required A and A-plus grades, just no places at university. It's disgraceful. Well, what's going on? Let's talk to Gerard, who wants to talk about it. Hi, Gerard and crew.
Hello, Michael.
How are
it
you,
comes
sir?
Down to, I'm okay, thank you. It all comes down to investment and more short-term planning than the next. Who's the next leader of the Conservative Party?
Yes.
So that applies to all of them. Look, in a past life, I did a job that arranged benefits for people. And in one, our local hospital had a recruitment exercise abroad to get doctors in and consultants because they couldn't in this country. They weren't enough trained.
Mm.
So quite rightly, they brought their families with them, children and aged parents. And I arranged benefits in 1 week for three sets of parents, which is, in all of them, in excess of £35,000 per annum. Times that by three just for that week alone, and that was £105,000 per annum in benefits. Now, when I pointed out that to my MP, he told me to keep my nose out of it ever so politely.
Very, really? That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, because all I said was that money could have been used to train some GPs, and we could have trained them at the expense of the state so they didn't rack up the debts themselves.
Right.
And that way you'd have got more people going into the profession.
Well, this is what they say, isn't it? This is what they say about the sort of the hidden part and the hidden cost, if you like, of immigration, because it's all very well to say freedom of movement is necessary. Yes, it is. Freedom of job opportunities, yes.
There's always a cost.
But hang on a second, because what if that person who's coming in to work wants to bring their family with them? And you go, well, of course they should be able to bring their wife and kids, but what about their parents? What about their siblings? You know, it seems very unclear to me what the policy is.
Well, when I tried to do the books with them and said, well, look, in some of these families, they had three or four children. So I said, how much is it per child that you allow for costs on that? So I said, let's conservatively say 5,000 each. For three children, that's 15,000 a year on top.
Right.
Before you think this is immigration bashing, look, I've got two dogs who occasionally have barked on your show when Sunderland fans have gone past.
I've heard that, yeah. You won't see too many Sunderland fans now after their second loss in a row, of course, in the playoff final.
No.
Just thought I'd slip that one in.
Yeah, and well done. But the vets that they see are both from abroad, and they're fantastic, and I owe a debt to them because they've saved their lives.
Yes.
There's one British vet in that practice, and he has to do another job after hours to cover his debts because
really?
He's got massive student debt.
That's mad, isn't it? But listen,
yeah,
I'm like you. I don't want people to think that I'm anti-immigration. I'm not anti-immigration at all. I mean, as I've often said, there are plenty of people who are indigenous to this country who were born here who I'd be more than happy to export to another country because they're completely useless. However, meanwhile, I also understand that we are a relatively small country and you can't just keep importing people with families just because you need to fill one veterinary practice's job. You bring in six people.
Correct.
You know, that's where it's wrong.
You won't catch me arguing with that because as I've said before, there's always a cost. Nothing is for free.
Right.
And we need to invest in our own. Keep bringing immigrants in. Get some of the immigrants to train our British kids.
Sure.
But invest in our kids for the future and stop thinking short term. The attitude was that this money was coming out of the Department of Work and Pensions benefits budget, so it didn't matter. The hospital wasn't concerned. It was off their books, the fact that it was being supplemented by you and me with extra benefits.
Yes.
It's always a cost.
How about this, right? Jeff has just sent this in by Twitter. My daughter's a veterinary nurse, did her qualifications via day release at college. She could have done the same at university, but she got paid a salary, got 3 years' work experience, and came out with the same qualification and no debt. Her friends doing the same course at uni have now owe £30,000. Now, that's another interesting way to do it, isn't it?
Well, it's another way to do it, but you've also got companies who rely on bringing in immigration because they don't have to train them up. There's a cost to training.
Yes.
And it's off the books. Let somebody else do the training for them, the cost of training. It's off their books. And then when you bring him in, you don't have to pay him as much either because it'll be supplemented by the taxpayer.
Yes, absolutely right. It's fascinating, this stuff. I always love talking to people like Gerard because he always brings something to the party, which is what a lot of people do on this show. Gerard, thanks for your call. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. It's got a Spice Girls vibe to the show today, isn't there? It's a sort of, there's a very much of a feminine touch going on, which is very nice. 0344-499-1000 is the number to call. We've got lots and lots of people to talk to. We haven't got a great deal of time to do it in. Matthew Wright coming up, of course, at 1 o'clock. We'll be bringing you all sorts of things throughout the day here at Talk Radio. He's in the company of Kevin O'Sullivan. We're going to speak to Mark Dolan in a moment about the comedy brain, which appears to have gone missing. I don't know why or where it is, but let's talk to Rudy first in Exeter. Hello, Rudy.
Hi, Mike. Nice to speak to you again.
Nice to speak to you. What do you want to say?
I want to say that I'm really annoyed about this person prosecuting Boris Johnson, and he goes with this line that he doesn't know people that lie. So why isn't he taking out a private prosecution against George Osborne that lied continually that, you know, people are going to lose their jobs,
yes,
the GDP is going to go down, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and he was the Chancellor of Exchequer that had access to all the information. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.